and the nine limbs well understood from the histories of other species who had employed similar weapons in the long galactic past, what unpleasant and debilitating effects such weaponry might have on an undefendable animal body. The puzzle for the nine limbs was this. Why would these primitives employ such weapons in preference to their usual armorarium of explosively propelled penetrants, which produced even more destructive effects on organic bodies? When the encounter on the surface was over, the decision-makers among the nine-limbed crew debated for many minutes before deciding whether to report what they had seen. In the long run, they did. They reported it exactly and in detail, letting the Grand Galactics make of it what they would, although the nine limbs did attempt to give themselves a little wiggle room by the title they gave the report. An example of an anomalous encounter. Chapter 12. Judgment. Ranjit didn't see much of the actual bloodshed, being totally absorbed by his own humiliatingly nasty problems. Apart from the fact that he felt as though a herd of mad swine had been stampeding through his digestive system, the subsonics had, as they were programmed to do, caused him voluminously to foul himself. He had not done anything like that since early childhood, and he had forgotten how repulsive a process it was. He managed to strip off the soiled garments and stagger back into the warm wavelets, using the least filthy of his own clothing to scrub himself nearly clean. After that, he had a plan. He looted the bag of George Kanakaratnam's clothing that Dot had given him. There were no shoes in the bag, and Ranjit chose not to put on another man's underwear. But all the rest was there, slacks and pullover shirts, and thick, woolly socks that Ranjit hoped might protect his feet from the sharp-edged pebbles of the beach. Then he stepped out of concealment to take stock of the situation. It looked bad, and smelled worse. The choppers had landed and positioned themselves in orderly ranks, and now they disgorged at least 100 armed troops, probably either Indian or Pakistani, Ranjit guessed, though he was not familiar enough with either to guess which. Whoever they were, they had efficiently separated the former cruise ship population into four clusters. Two were made up of the former passengers, one group for men, one for women, and what the clusters amounted to were enclosures made up of hastily strung up sheets along the water's edge. Half a dozen soldiers were handing out towels and blankets to the passengers who had cleaned themselves as much as they intended to. Ranjit noted that the soldiers helping the female passengers were female themselves. In the uniforms, wielding their weapons, they had all looked interchangeably sexless. A couple of dozen meters down the shore, 20 or 30 men and women, unguarded, were doing their best to clean themselves as well. They didn't have anyone to hand them towels, but a stack of the things was available for the taking on the beach. Ranjit could identify them as rescued crew by the few he recognized, but he actually would have known who they were anyway by the rapturous looks of relief these saved-at-the-last-minute souls wore on their faces. There was one other cluster. These had not been allowed to clean themselves or change their clothes. They lay flat on their faces, fingers locked atop their heads, and they were guarded by 3 or 4 of the soldiers, weapons at the ready. There was no doubt which group they represented. Ranjit scanned the prostrate forms, but if any of the Kanakaratnams were there, he could not recognize them from their backs. None looked small enough to be any of the younger children, either. One of the soldiers guarding them was taking an interest in Ranjit, shouting something Ranjit could not make out and waving his rifle meaningfully. It seemed to Ranjit that walking around on his own made the soldiers suspicious. "Right," he called to the soldier, hoping he knew what he was agreeing to, and looked around at his options. Which group Ranjit actually belonged to was hard to say. Still, there was no doubt that the former passengers were getting the best treatment, so he flipped a soft salute to the soldier and then strolled over to those waiting for fresh clothing at the men's side and attached himself to the line, nodding pleasantly to the oldster just ahead of him, who didn't nod back. Instead, he scowled at Ranjit for a moment, then opened his mouth and let out a yell for the soldiers. When a couple of them came running, the man was shouting, "This one's no passenger! He's one of them! He's the one who was trying to get me to tell how much my kids would pay to ransom me!" which is why, a moment later, Ranjit wound up lying face down, his hands on his head, between a pair of the largest and, because they had been given no chance to clean themselves up, smelliest of the pirates. He kept on lying there for hours. Those hours were not totally without anything happening, because in the first of them, Ranjit learned two important lessons. The first was that he shouldn't try to lift his head enough to try to look for the Kanakaratnams, because when he did, he was hit with a stick just above his left ear, while whoever was wielding the stick yelled, "Lie still!" The pain of the strike was like a lightning bolt. The second was that he shouldn't try whispering to his neighbors for information. That got him a serious kick right about where his lowest right-hand rib was. The pain from the kick was indescribable, and the kicker was a soldier all right because he was definitely wearing steel-braced army shoes. After about 2 hours, when the tropical sun had mounted high in the sky and Ranjit was beginning to feel as though he were being baked alive, something did happen. A new fleet of helicopters arrived, bigger and a good deal more comfortable-looking than the first, and immediately boarded all the passengers, and all those passengers reclaimed possessions to take them to what no doubt would be a nicer place than this. An hour or so more, and there was a sound of heavy-duty engines from the brush, and a couple of flatbed trucks pushed their way onto the sand to take the rescued crew away. And later still, much later, when the sun had done its best to parboil the helpless pirates, Ranjit included, it was their turn. It was helicopters again this time, big ones that didn't look comfortable at all. The man in charge was identifiable by the amount of metallic embroidery on his uniform and cap, and by the facts that he arrived in his own helicopter, and that before he got out of it, other soldiers had immediately prepared a chair and a table, well, an upended box, to be more accurate, for him to sit at as he dispensed judgment. Each of the pirates, one by one, was commanded to stand up and answer the officer's questions. Ranjit couldn't hear the questions or answers, but the verdicts were delivered clearly enough to be heard by all.
"Rawalpindi, Central Jail," the officer said to the first prisoner, and again, "Rawalpindi, Central Jail," to the second and the third.
Ranjit was next to be summoned before the dispenser of justice. He took advantage of the few moments he had between getting to his feet and facing the officer to hastily look over the remaining pirates for a sign of the children, but if they were there, Ranjit could not identify them. Then he was standing before the officer and did not dare look farther. His questioning was brief. The officer listened while another soldier spoke in his ear, then addressed Ranjit.
"What is your name?"
he asked, gratefully in English.
"I am Ranjit Subramanian, son of Ganesh Subramanian, who is the high priest of the Tiru temple in Trincomalee in Sri Lanka. I was not one of the pirates."
The officer stopped him.
"Wait," he said,
and said something inaudible to his aide, who equally inaudibly replied. The officer mulled over that information in silence for a moment. Then he leaned forward, his head close to Ranjit, and inhaled deeply. Then he nodded. Ranjit had passed the smell test and could therefore be tolerated as a traveling companion.
"Interrogation," he said. "Put him in my aircraft. Next."
Chapter 13. A Convenient Place for Questioning. Beginning to end, Ranjit was in the hands of the interrogators for just over 2 years. But it was only in the first 6 months that much actual interrogation went on. His stay, however, was not at any point comfortable. Ranjit's first inkling that this would be the case was when he was blindfolded, gagged, and handcuffed to a seat in the judging officer's helo before it took off. Where he was then flown to, he could not say, although it took less than an hour to get there. Then, still blindfolded, he was helped down the steps to some sort of paved surface, and then was walked 20 or 30 meters to some other steps, these going up into some other aircraft. There he was cuffed once more to his seat, and then the new plane took off. This one wasn't a helicopter. Ranjit could feel the bumps in the runway as the aircraft gained speed, and then the sudden transition to bumpless, free flight. It wasn't a short flight, either. and it certainly wasn't a sociable one. Ranjit could hear the aircrew talking to one another, though in what language he could not say, but when he tried calling out to let them know he needed to go to the bathroom, the answer he got was not in words. It was a sudden hard blow to the side of his face, unexpected and unbraced for. Nevertheless, they did, ultimately, let him use the plane's little toilet, though still blindfolded and with the door kept open. They fed him, too. That is, they opened his seat's tray and put something on it and ordered, "Eat!" By feel, he determined that it was some kind of sandwich, possibly cheese of an unfamiliar variety, but by then it had been nearly 20 hours since Ranjit had had anything to eat, and he devoured it dry. He did take a chance to ask for water, and got a repeat of the blow to the side of the head. How long they flew, Ranjit could not say, because he drifted off to an uneasy sleep, waking only when the jittery bouncing of the aircraft told him they were landing, and on a much worse runway than before. He didn't get the blindfold removed. He did get helped out of the plane and into some kind of vehicle, in which he was driven for more than an hour. He wound up being led, still blindfolded, into some sort of building, down a hall, and into a room where his captors sat him down. Then one of them spoke to him in a gruff, accented English.
"Hold out hands in front of you. No, with palms up."
And when he did, he was struck on the palms with something brutally heavy. The pain was sharp. Ranjit couldn't help crying out. Then the voice again.
"Now you tell truth. What is name?"
That was the first question Ranjit was asked under duress, and the one asked most often of all. His questioners did not choose to believe the simple fact that he was Ranjit Subramanian, who chanced to be wearing some garments belonging to somebody else, whose name, as shown by the labels stitched to the garments, was Kirthis Kanakaratnam. Each time he gave the truthful answer, they exacted the penalty for lying. This was different for each of the questioners. When it was the stubby, sweaty man named Bruno asking the questions, his favorite weapon for gaining truth was a length of electrical cable, 4 or 5 centimeters thick, and capable of inflicting extreme pain wherever it was employed. Alternatively, Bruno would give Ranjit a violent, open-handed slap on his bare belly. This was not only painful, it made Ranjit wonder every time it was applied if it might not be rupturing his appendix or spleen. But there was something comforting about Bruno's technique. No fingernails were extracted, no bones broken, no eyes gouged out. It seemed, hopefully to Ranjit, that they were not doing anything that would leave a permanent mark, and what that suggested to Ranjit was that they might ultimately be planning to let him go. That hope, however, didn't last. It vanished when, one day, Bruno exasperatedly threw his electrical cable across the room, grabbed up a short wooden club from the table of useful implements, and repeatedly smashed Ranjit across the face with it. That cost Ranjit a black eye and a knocked-out front tooth, as well as most of his tenuously held hope for ultimate release. The other main torturer was an elderly man who never gave a name but had one eye always half-closed. Ranjit thought of him as Squinty. He seldom left a mark on Ranjit, and he was curiously reassuring in his conversation. On the very first day Ranjit met him, Ranjit held by 2 powerful assistants flat on his back, Squinty held up a square of cloth. "What we will do to you now," he warned politely, "will make you think you are going to die. You won't. I won't let that happen. Only you must answer my questions truthfully." And then he spread the cloth over Ranjit's face and poured cold water over it from a metal pitcher. Ranjit had never experienced anything quite like it. The effect wasn't so much pain as brutalizing, incapacitating terror. Ranjit had not failed to hear and understand that Squinty had promised he wouldn't die of this experience, but his body had understandings of its own. It knew that it was being terminally, lethally drowned, and it wanted the process stopped at once. "Help!" Ranjit cried, or tried to cry. "Stop!"
Let me up!
And all that came out was a bubbly, choky splatter of watery parts of sound, none of them like any English words. The trickle of poured water stopped. The cloth was pulled off his face, and Ranjit was lifted to sitting position.
No. What is your name?
Squinty asked politely. Ranjit tried to stop coughing long enough to get the words out.
I'm Ranjit Sub,
he began, but he didn't even finish saying his name before his shoulders were slammed back onto the floor, the cloth was over his face again, and the terrible pouring of water began once more. Ranjit managed to hold out four times more before the heart was gone out of him. Further resistance was impossible, and he gasped and managed to say,
I'm whoever you want me to be. Just stop.
Good, said Squinty encouragingly.
We are making progress, Kirtis Kanakaratnam. So now tell me, what country were you working for?
There were, of course, many other ways of making a subject become cooperative, but of course none of them produced any truthful confessions from Ranjit, since he had no crimes to confess. This exasperated his interrogators. The one he called Squinty complained,
You are making us look bad, Ranjit, or Kirthis, or whoever you are. Listen to me. It will go easier for you if you just stop denying you are Kirthis Kanakaratnam.
Ranjit tried taking the advice. Then it did go easier, a little. Chapter 14 Rendition to the Highest Bidder. Although Ranjit hadn't known any part of it, quite a few things had been going on outside the walls of his place of detention. Cathedrals had been blown up, railroad trains derailed, office buildings poisoned with radioactive dust in their ventilation systems. And assassinations? Oh, yes, there had been plenty of assassinations, by throat-cutting or defenestration from an upper floor, by handgun, shotgun, and assault rifle, quite often by poisoning administered in sometimes quite ingenious ways. Not to mention, in one case, assassination by dropping a piano on the victim's head, and in another, by standing on the victim's chest to hold him to the bottom of his bathtub as its taps filled it with lukewarm water. And, of course, there were the wars. Perhaps the most violent of the new ones revived an old plague spot as a Sunni incursion into Kurdish territory threatened to set off another round of the turmoil that characterized post-occupation Iraq. However, not everything that had transpired had been bad. Under the close supervision of four of the five Scandinavian nations, Iceland, with its own domestic unrest, stayed outside the group. Several of the most bitterly fought wars were in, however brief, remission. Even Myanmar, the country that was more commonly called Burma, except by its own intransigent governing clique, had without warning released all of its political prisoners and invited foreign diplomats to monitor its next set of elections. Finally, a development that would have greatly pleased Ranjit if he could have known of it, after endless stalling, the World Bank had come through with a decent $1 billion startup grant for an actual Artsudanov space elevator. True, a World Bank grant was a long way from the actual wheels turning, with the cars going up and down the cables, the hardware that you could hop onto and be drawn to low Earth orbit at 300 kilometers an hour. But it was a real first step. Those, of course, were not the only data with a significant bearing on his own life that Ranjit did not know. For example, he didn't know why he had been taken to this place and why he had been tortured in it. And then, when the torturing had stopped, he didn't know why that had happened either. Ranjit had never heard of extraordinary rendition or the momentous decision that had been handed down decades earlier by the British law lords. Of course, Ranjit's torturers could have helped him out with some information if they had chosen to. They didn't choose to. After the first day without inflicted pain, he didn't see Bruno, the belly slap and electrical cable guy, again at all. He did see Squinty quite often, but only after Squinty had extracted a promise from him that he would stop asking why he had been tortured and whether he would ever be released, and indeed pretty much any question that Ranjit really wanted answered. Squinty did supply a tiny bit of information.
Bruno? Oh, he's been promoted upstairs. He just doesn't know what to do with a prisoner unless he's hurting him, and it doesn't look like we're going to be hurting you anymore.
That was, Ranjit reminded himself, a fact of life not to be scorned. It was a big improvement over the previous diet of thrashings and waterboardings. But it was, especially after Squinty quit coming around because Ranjit couldn't keep his promise to stop asking forbidden questions, pretty damn boring. Ranjit wasn't left entirely without human company. There was a limping old man who brought him his food and carried away his slop buckets, but that one was no use for conversation. He no doubt spoke some language or other, but it didn't seem to be one that Ranjit possessed. Ranjit didn't know when he first began to have long, one-sided talks with his friends, with his absent friends, that is, since none of them was physically present in his cell. Of course, none of them could hear what he said to them. It would have been interesting if, for example, Myra de Souza could have, or Prue No Name. Less interesting for Gamini Bandara, because after reporting on his own emptily monotonous existence, about all Ranjit had to say to his absent lifelong friend was that he really should have budgeted more time to be with Ranjit and less for the American woman who, after all, would never see him again. Some of Ranjit's best absent friends were people he had never known in the flesh. For instance, there was the no longer living Paul Wufschel. Wufschel had been a 19th-century German business tycoon whose best-beloved sweetheart had turned down his proposal of marriage. That meant that in spite of all his wealth and power, life was no longer worth living for Wufschel, so he sensibly decided to commit suicide. That didn't work out, though. While Wufschel was waiting for the exact right moment to do himself in, he idly picked up a book to read. The book chanced to concern Fermat's Last Theorem, written by a man named Ernst Kummer. As it happened, Wufschel had attended a couple of Kummer's lectures on number theory. Curiosity made him read the new essay. And, like many other amateur mathematicians before and after, Wufschel was immediately hooked. He forgot about killing himself, being too busy trying to plumb the mysteries of a squared plus b squared equals c squared, and the paradox that if the quantities were cubed, they never did equal each other. Then there was the also long-deceased Sophie Germain, whose teenage years had been spent during the frightening time of the French Revolution. Why this should have persuaded young Sophie to resolve on a career in mathematics is not immediately obvious, but it did. Of course, that was not an easy ambition for a female to accomplish. As Elizabeth I of England had once put it, Sophie was cursed by being split rather than fringed. And so everything she tried to do was vastly harder for her than for her fringed colleagues. Then, when his imaginary conversation partners ran out of steam, something Myra de Souza had said began to cudgel Ranjit's mind. What had it been? Something about seeing what tools other mathematicians had possessed at the time Fermat had jotted his cursed boast in the margin of his book? Well, what tools were they? He remembered that Sophie Germain was said to have been the first mathematician of any gender to make any headway at all with the Fermat proof. So just what headway had she made? Ranjit, of course, had no way of looking that up. Back at the university, equipped with a password, all he would have had to do was hit a few keys on the handiest computer, and the damn woman's entire life production would have been laid out for him to study. But he didn't have the computer. All he had was his memory, and he was not sure that it was adequate to the task at hand. He did remember what a Sophie Germain prime was. That is, any prime, P, such that 2P plus 1 was also a prime. 3 was the littlest Sophie Germain prime. 3 times 2 plus 1 equals 7, and 7 was a prime, all right. Most of the other Sophie Germain primes were much larger and thus hardly any fun at all. Ranjit was quite pleased with himself for remembering this, though no matter how much he thought about it, he could not see any way in which a Sophie Germain prime could lead him to a solution of the Fermat problem. There was one other thing. After profound labor, Germain had produced a theorem of her own. If x, y, and z are integers, and if x to the fifth plus y to the fifth equals z to the fifth, then x, y, or z must be divisible by 5. Like every other stepping stone toward a proof that Ranjit had managed to quarry out of the refractory stone of his mind, this one was a disappointment. The equation made no sense. Fermat's whole theorem was supposed to prove that no such equality as x to the fifth plus y to the fifth equals z to the fifth could ever exist in the first place. So it wasn't of any use at all. Or was it? That is, forget Sophie Germain's useless theorem itself, but how did she get to it? And wasn't that what Myra had suggested to him at Dr. Vorhulst's party back in the days when Ranjit could sometimes go to a party? There was one other person, well, sort of person, with whom Ranjit had never, or never yet, had any personal dealings, but who, or which, could have supplied him with very useful data. It is probably about time that we spent a little more time with him, or them, or it, or maybe even her. Chapter 15. Introduction to One, or More, Grand Galactics. The first thing we need to straighten out about this grand galactic person is whether in fact he was a he, or indeed a person, or ultimately a, rather than some fraction of a, grand galactic. None of those questions has an easy answer. So what we're going to do here is we're going to ignore the facts and settle for answers that are no problem for us to deal with, apart from their being just plain wrong. First, we will say that this person is really a person, in spite of also being a part of that larger person that was all the grand galactics combined. There were grand galactics all over the place, from the galaxy's accelerating fringes to its relatively motionless core, and just about everywhere in between. How many grand galactics were there? That's also a meaningless question. There were many, many of them. But when you came right down to it, the many were also one, because whenever he chose, every grand galactic was instantly merged with any or every other. As you have noticed, we just arbitrarily assigned gender to the grand galactic's pronoun. Don't assume from this that they practiced sexual intercourse in any sense understandable by a human being. They didn't. It is just that we can't go on with that it or he or they business forever, so we just cut the Gordian knot and made him a he. We have just taken one rather large liberty. Let's take another. Let's give him a name. We'll call him, quote, Bill. Not Bill, quote, Bill. It is a major liberty that we have taken, and we should acknowledge that we know it to be so by the use of quotation marks. Now, what else would it be useful for us to know about the grand galactics at this time? For example, would it be helpful to know how big they are? Or at least, since one node of grand galactics may be thousands or billions of light years from some particular other node, how they measure distance? Let's assume it would, indeed, be helpful, but we must also recognize that, as with all questions about the grand galactics, the answer is going to be complicated. Start with the fact that the grand galactics don't like the kind of arbitrary units of measurements human beings use. When you track those down, they are always based on some human value, such as the distance from a man's fingertip to his armpit, or some calculated fraction of the distance from a pole to the equator on the particular planet that humans chance to occupy. Grand galactic measurements are always made on the Planck scale, which is actually quite tiny. The measure of a single Planck unit is 1.616 times 10 to the negative 35th meters. The easiest way to understand how little that is to remember that it's so small it is impossible to measure anything smaller. Why impossible? Because you can't measure anything you can't see, and nothing can be seen without employing those light-carrying particles called photons, and any photon that was powerful enough to illuminate a Planck scale distance would be so extremely powerful, and thus so extremely massive, that it would immediately transform itself into a black hole. The word impossible is sometimes taken as a challenge. In this case, though, it's just a fact. So to measure anything in any of the three dimensions, whether it's the circumference of an electron or the diameter of the universe itself, grand galactics simply count the number of Planck distances along a line from point A to point B. That is invariably a large number, but that's all right with the grand galactics. Looked at in one way, they are pretty large numbers themselves. So, having found ways of at least identifying the ununderstandable, let's get back to that much simpler being, Ranjit Subramanian. When Ranjit was quite young, his highly ecumenical father encouraged him to read some rather strange books, one of which, by a writer named James Branch Cabell, was about the nature of writing and writers. For a time, Ganesh Subramanian thought that might be a career choice for his son. What some would-be writers were trying to say to the world, Cabell wrote, was, "I am pregnant with words and I must have lexicological parturition or I die." And, curiously, that is almost exactly the condition Ranjit now felt himself to be in. For days now, Ranjit had been pleading for help, shouting into the empty hallways, explaining, though no one seemed to be listening, that he had something that absolutely had to be communicated to a journal at once. There were no answers. Even the limping old man was now just putting Ranjit's meals inside the door and limping away as fast as he could. So when Ranjit heard the old man's step slide coming along the empty corridors, he felt little interest, except that this time there was, along with it, the rap-tap-tap of the footsteps of someone who wasn't limping at all. A moment later, Ranjit's cell door opened. The old man was there, but deferentially a step or two behind another man, a man who wore an expression of shock and dismay on a face whose lineaments Ranjit knew as well as he knew his own. "Sweet God Almighty, Ranj!" Gamini Bandara said wonderingly. "Is that really you?" Of all the questions Ranjit might have asked this unexpected visitor from his past, he chose the simplest. "What are you doing here, Gamini?" "What the hell do you think I'm doing? I'm going to get you out of here, and if you think that was easy, you're crazier than you look. Then we'll get you to a dentist. What happened to your front teeth? Or no, I suppose first you need to see a doctor." "What?" Ranjit was standing now, almost quivering with excitement. "Not a doctor. If you can get me out of here, get me to a computer." Gamini looked puzzled. "A computer? Well, sure, that can be arranged, but first we need to make sure you're all right." "Damn it, Gamini," Ranjit cried. "Can't you understand what I'm saying? I think I've got the proof. I need a computer, and I need it right now. Do you have any idea how terrified I am that I'll forget some part of the proof before I can get it refereed?" Ranjit got the doctor. He got the computer, too. In fact, got both of them at the same time, but not until Gamini had walked him out of his prison to where a helicopter waited, its vane turning over. As Ranjit climbed into the chopper, he saw a couple of men standing nearby. Squinty was one of them. Squinty looked astonished and worried, but didn't even gesture a goodbye. Then a 20-minute downhill flight among great mountains that wore brilliant caps of ice. In the helicopter, Ranjit could not help turning to Gamini with questions, but this time it was Gamini who didn't want to talk. "Later," he said, nodding at the chopper pilot, who wore a uniform Ranjit had never seen before. They landed at a real airport, a scant dozen meters from a plane, and not just any plane, Ranjit saw, but a BAB-2200, the fastest and, in some configurations, the most luxurious aircraft Boeing Airbus had ever built, and it wore the blue globe and wreath United Nations insignia. Inside, it was even more so. Its seating was in leather armchairs, and its crew consisted of a pilot wearing the uniform of a colonel in the American Air Force, and two very pretty flight attendants wearing the same uniforms but with captain's bars and over the uniform fluffy white aprons.
"Heading for home now, sir?"
the pilot asked Gamini. He got a nod for an answer and immediately disappeared into the cockpit. One of the attendants led Ranjit to a chair, which he discovered swiveled, and belted him in.
"That's Jeannie," Gamini informed him, while himself being belted into another chair. "She's a doctor, too, so you better let her check you out."
"The computer," Ranjit started to object. "Oh, you'll get your damn computer, Ranj, but first we have to get airborne. It'll just be a minute."
By then the two women had already retreated to their fold-down seats against the bulkhead, and sure enough, the plane had begun to move. And as soon as the seatbelt sign went off, the second of the attendants,
"I'm Amy, hi,"
was magicking a laptop out of the table next to Ranjit's chair, while the one named Jeannie was approaching with stethoscope, blood pressure machine, and several other instruments at the ready. Ranjit didn't protest. He let the doctor poke and prod and listen as much as she liked, while he himself slowly and clumsily typed out pages of a nearly 6-page manuscript, pausing every couple of lines to ask Gamini if he could find the address of the magazine called Nature for him.
"Their offices are in England somewhere."
Or just to scowl at the keyboard until memory at last told him what the next line should be. It was a slow process, but when Gamini ventured to ask him if he wanted anything to eat, Ranjit ferociously and unarguably told him to shut up.
"Just give me 10 minutes, he demanded. "Oh, maybe half an hour at the most. I can't stop now."
It wasn't 10 minutes, of course. Wasn't half an hour, either. It was well over an hour before Ranjit looked up, sighed, and said to Gamini, "I need to check everything, so I'd better send a copy to your house. Tell me your email address." And when he had typed that in, he at last pushed the icon marked send, and then sat back.
"Thanks," he said.
"I'm sorry to have been such a pest, but it was pretty important to me. Ever since I figured it out 5 or 6 months ago, I've been terrified that I might forget some part of it before I could get it refereed."
He paused, suddenly licking his lips.
"And one other thing. For a long time I've been thinking about real food. Do you have, say, any fresh fruit juice on this plane? Any kind? And maybe something like a ham sandwich, or maybe a couple of scrambled eggs?"
Chapter 16. Homegoing. Gamini refused to listen to any talk of American breakfasts, but simply signaled to the flight attendants, who produced a fine Sri Lankan meal, string hoppers of woven rice, a rich curry of meat and potatoes, and a plate of papadoms, causing Ranjit's eyes to bulge in wonder.
"Tell me, Gamini," he ordered, already chewing, "when did you get to be God? Isn't this an American plane?"
Gamini, sipping a cup of tea that had come from the fields around Kandy, shook his head. "It's a United Nations plane," he said, "which happens to have an American crew, only it's not on either UN or US business right now. We just borrowed it to go after you."
"And we is..."
Gamini shook his head again, grinning.
"Can't tell you, or anyway, not right now. Pity. I knew you'd be interested, and as a matter of fact, I was considering asking you if you wanted to join us when you went off on your little cruise."
Ranjit didn't put his spoon down, but he held it motionless while he gave his friend a long and not entirely friendly look.
"You're telling me that you're such an important person that you can just borrow a plane like this to run your errands for you?"
This time, Gamini laughed out loud.
"Me? No! They didn't do it for me. They did it because my dad requested it. He's got this high-up UN job, you see."
"And what job is that?"
"Can't tell you that either, so don't ask. And don't ask what country you've just got out of either. Finding where you were wasn't hard after we got hold of Tiffany Kanakaratnam."
"Oh," he said, taking note of Ranjit's response to the child's name, That's something I can tell you about, anyway, at least up to a point. I used my father's position to run my own computer search for you, sort of the way you got your math teacher's password. I fed in every name I could think of that might possibly know anything about where you were, Myra de Souza, and Maggie, and Prue, and all your teachers, and all the monks that worked for your father, and the Kanakaratnams. No, he said, again answering the look that had appeared on Ranjit's face. There wasn't anything to embarrass you. We were just looking for meetings or conversations you'd had after the day you disappeared. We got nothing. Didn't get any data on the adult Kanakaratnams at all, which I think means they were shot out of hand along with the rest of the pirates by the first court that tried them. But I kept adding names as I thought of them, and when I put the names of the four children in, we found them. They'd been arrested, of course, but they were too young to be tried even on a piracy charge, so they were taken to some relatives near Kilinochi, and Tiffany gave us a description of the people who took you away. She described the helicopters and where you washed ashore. It took a lot of searching after that, to be sure, but at last I located you. You might have sat there for years more. And the people who took me were? Oh, Ranj, Kamini said, there you go again. I can't exactly tell you that, except, I guess, in sort of general terms without mentioning any specifics. Have you ever heard of extraordinary rendition? Or the Law Lord's findings on torture? Ranjit hadn't, but Kamini filled him in after his friend had woken from a deep sleep that had lasted hours. Back in the bad old days, some great powers such as the United States were on record as opposed to using torture to extract information. However, they kept finding themselves in possession of some captives who surely knew things that were important, but that they would never voluntarily say. Torture was an unreliable way of making people give truthful answers. At a certain stage, almost anyone would say whatever their interrogators wanted to hear, true or not, just to make it stop. But these great powers had no better way available. So they worked out a little plan. Captives of that sort were handed over to the intelligence services of some other country, one that had never promised to abjure the infliction of pain as a technique in questioning, and then the information would be passed back to the United States or whatever other great power had requested it. And that, Kamini finished, was extraordinary rendition. Extraordinary because that's what it was. Rendition in the sense of rendering, meaning turning over, like rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, as the Christians say.